Everybody likes guns. They just don't know it. Deep inside of his soul, there's a cowboy trying to get out.
Welcome to New Shooter Canada. Please remember that the show's content and word pronunciation is simply the opinion of the hosts and their guests.
Hello and welcome to episode 139 of New Shooter Canada. I'm your host, Mike Hissen, and tonight with me we have a couple of special guests, Jeremy and Jason from the Reloading Podcast. Hey guys.
Hey.
How you doing?
And we also have Thomas and Benny on here as well.
Hey guys.
What's up?
All right, so since you're our guest, Jeremy, why don't you go first? What have you been up to lately in guns?
Here lately, just basically been putting together some 308 match loads for F-class. It's pre-stat load, so I won't say exactly what I use over the radio here or whatever, the podcast. Been doing that, loading 45 with some cast bullets that I cast. That's about it, other than just kind of search for some parts for my 7-year-old daughter's AR-15 and 6.5 Grendel that I'm putting together for. That's about it.
Is that going to be for F-class as well?
No, that is going to be for deer hunting. She wants to start deer hunting this year, so she'll turn 8, and then about a month later will be the youth weekend for deer season. And she wants to drop the deer with her own rifle. So
that's awesome.
Excellent.
She's such a wow. Small girl that I tried looking at youth rifles.
Okay.
And the length of pull on them were still too large for her. Okay. She's got a length of pull of like 10 1/4, 10 1/2 inches. I mean, she's an extremely small girl, and the only thing I could come up with was a AR platform with a collapsible buttstock.
And that'll collapse far enough down for her?
Oh, yeah. It collapses just far enough where it fits her perfectly, length of pull. And then the buttstock that I bought has a adjustable cheek rest.
Okay.
So I'm able to raise that cheek weld all the way up so she can get a good solid weld.
Well, that's good. What kind of distances are you shooting?
For deer, I shot one last year at 175 yards, 30-30. I can reach up to about 250.
Okay.
For the shot that I have from my one stand. Then I got a couple other stands where, I mean, it wouldn't be any longer than, say, 125 yards.
Okay, so relatively close in.
Oh, yeah, well within the 6.5 Grendel ballistic range.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Jason, how about you?
I bettered the 20 MOA rail on my rifle a little while ago, and today I finally got to take it back out and re-zero it, and then at 100. And then we went out to another spot where we can shoot 500 and set up the steel. And I went with a couple of guys I work with, and it was pretty warm by the time we got out to the 500-yard spot. So we set up the pop-up and got everybody's rifles dialed in and talked for a little while and then cleaned up and came home.
What size of steel were you shooting at?
That's 10-inch steel I have.
10-inch steel at 500 yards?
Yep. 2 MOA.
Excellent.
That's nice, yeah. Don't see a lot of places to shoot that far up here.
Yeah, they're kind of hard to come by. One of my coworkers knows ranchers up in this area, and so we get permission. At the 500-yard area, we get permission to go whenever we want. But there's also another one that we shot at, and we can get over 1,000. I'm not sure if it's 1,100 or what, but that guy is harder to get to give us permission. So we just take what we can get.
Yeah. That's still pretty good. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Thomas, how about you?
I actually went shooting. I actually competed in the match today, actually.
Oh, wow. And, really?
Yeah. And
match was there today?
The Orson match up at the club.
What is that?
ORSA is, before IPSC, the only shooting you had in Ontario was called the Ontario Recreational Sporting Association, and it's been defunct for probably about 30 years. So my club likes to shoot it because that way they don't have any outside influence on the club. They don't want to get involved in IPSC or IDPA because they don't want anybody else telling them the rules. They want to run everything, which is fine. You know, it's a club league. They're entitled to do what they want. There's a couple of things I don't like about it, though. Well, what happened is that when I got there, it was so bad that we weren't allowed to do any running between stages because it was literally it was like a foot of mud down at the end. So they set up two different steel stages on the left and the right. And when I got up there, there's people down shooting when the rain kicked up and everybody ran up and hid back in the covered point, of the rifle shooting area. And what had happened, it was funny. There's one of the guys there, one of the top shooters there, actually, when we were inside, he got chastised by the RO because he unholstered the gun and put it in the case before he was told to. So the guy, I thought he was getting kind of pissy and he got mad and he left. And that wasn't the case at all, because what I discovered, they did the same thing they did to me last time. They partnered everybody up with a partner. And when he left, they gave me his spot and I got his partner. So now I know why he left, because once again, they put me up with the worst shooter in the whole club. There's no classifications where you shoot with a shooter or a master class or a C class shoot together. It's just random draw. So you can have somebody that's a really good shot and you can have somebody that shouldn't really have a gun in their hand, as far as I'm concerned. So they set up the stages. Excuse me. So they're both 12 shots each. One has hostage targets and a couple steel. One's all steel. So they put me up. I won't say his name. So they put me up with this guy and I said, whatever stage you think you can do best, you do best, and I'll do whatever one. So, buzzer goes off. I shoot the stage, and I shoot really well. I got the highest score of the day, and I even missed one target, and I had to fire two shots. So I added 2 seconds in my score, but it was a clean shot, no penalties. And, I get the command to, unload, holster, show clear, put my holster, and I look over, and my partner is still shooting. He's still fumbling with his revolver. I finished in 25 seconds. He took like 65, double my score. So the next time we go back, I said, okay, let's switch. We'll do the other side. Same thing. I fire it perfectly clean, fastest score. Nobody's touched my score on that stage. I blew everybody out of the water. I look over at my partner who's still shooting because it's a combined score, and he's fumbling to get the mags into his 9mm, and he can't get them in there. Again, I'm waiting 40 seconds for him to finish his stage. I'm getting really, really ticked, but I'm being nice to the guy. So he changes guns and I walk over to him and he's got a Wilson Combat, not a Wilson Combat. He's got a Wilson Combat Magwell, but he's got the Chick McCormick, the Power 10 magazines. So the 10-round 45 ACP mags, but they've got that big rubber or big plastic thing on the bottom. And I notice he's got an aftermarket Magwell in it. And I said, you're going to have problems with that, because I had the same issue years ago. I said, the bumper pads on that magazine are going to interfere with your gun and you're not going to be able to see your mag. He said, oh, no, I've never had a problem with this gun. She's only on the 9mm. I'll be fine. I said, you sure? I said, I got extra 8-round 10, 45 mags you can use. He goes, no, I'm fine. So the last stage I go up and I smoke it. I do the whole thing in like 20 seconds, super fast. I blow everybody out of the water and I turn around and this guy's fumbling to get his Wilson mags or those Chip McCormick mags into the gun. And they're getting snagged up on Wilson Combat, Magwell. And I'm getting angry and angry because I told him he was going to have a problem. He ignored me and he took 60 seconds. So I'm sitting there and I'm watching him and he's trying to force the mag into the gun. I see his finger in the trigger and I'm about to lose it. And I'm not even the RO. I'm his partner watching him being unsafe. So we got smoked because this guy took so long.
And if he got DQ'd, would that reflect?
We both get DQ'd.
Oh, that's right? A mess. Oh, come on. That's not fair.
So it really bothers. Even... Yeah. It's like if you go to any match, you don't get a high master shooting against a Tyro. You put people in compatible categories, but we don't do that at this club. Guy can show up with an open gun and I could show up with my stock Grand Power or my Ruger P94 and I'm still going up against him. Same with the classes. So that kind of took, like I shot really well, but I was angry that I got stuck in that position. Because this is the second time it's happened to me where I did really, really well and I got brought down by somebody else. So that kind of ticks me that they don't do that. But I was happy with my performance. The ground power ran great. The new loads that I made made up worked perfectly. No issues. So hopefully they only do this when the weather gets bad and they have to have, you know, we either get put inside or if the down the range is too muddy to use safely, then they'll partner you up. So the next time they say, oh, we're going to do partners, I'm just going to do what the other guy did. Said, no, I'm going and leave. I'm not going to bother because it's not worth my time. You know, you're there to have fun, but you know, I still like to win.
Right. And if you had a semi-competent partner, that makes sense.
Yeah, like if I had, you know, if I'd be
give me a call next time.
Similar to me. Well, that's the thing. They won't let other outside people shoot it. That's another thing. Like if you came up to me, they would let you shoot service rifle, but they won't let outside members shoot the club league pistol. Except for PPC. You can come and shoot PPC with us, but the action pistol they won't. So I was kind of disappointed. I was brought down, but I was, you know, I was happy with my performance and I was actually be able to see the front sight for a change. So it was nice. But besides that, it was good. What about you, Mike? What'd you do with guns this week?
Well, I was going to let Benny go first.
Okay, Benny. Tell us about your fingers.
I have all of them.
Good.
Thank God. I, for the first time ever, made my own, I reloaded 9mm. And I got a really cheap scale, which my engineer of a father is constantly berating me for. He's like, well, if you know, honestly, if you're loading to point one of a decimal, you should really be going to your scale should really be to at least two decimal places to, you know, to make sure you're getting the right thing. So I obviously have to go purchase a much better scale. So but thank God I got all my fingers still. I got the Lee powder measure, and it did an okay job. It's not so consistent, but it's working, and I went off without a problem. I got a little bit of a scare when I didn't see one of my mags properly, and I pulled the trigger and went click and nothing happened, and I'm like, oh shoot, what's going on? And so I waited 30 seconds, pulled it again, nothing happened, looked down, noticed the mag wasn't seated properly, and then everything worked I fixed the problem and everything worked, so that was good. I was shooting next to that guy who was using a single action army, I think, in what was, currently had it in with a 45 ACP, cylinder in there. But it came with a 45 and a 45 long Colt, I think, 45 Colt, he said.
Was it a Ruger convertible?
I guess so. I didn't look too closely at that. I was more interested when he handed me his Prohib Python.
Oh, yes. That would pique your attention.
I think it was in 38, if I'm not mistaken. Did they make them in 38? 380, sorry. Not 38, 380. I don't know. It said 380 on the side, so I'm thinking that might have been the caliber. I don't know. So he was telling me about it. He was going to get it rebarreled to make it not restricted. But apparently, for a certain time period, they used a different thread pitch on their barrels for the pythons, and he has one of those. So he did actually find restricted barrels that he could switch it out, but he had the wrong pitch, so he didn't end up doing that. So yeah, that's what I did with guns this week, I guess.
All right. Well, I got out to the range. I tested the 9-pound trigger, hammer spring in my GP100, using the new shim so that it wouldn't drag on the frame of the gun, hoping that that would help make it work. I got about 5 light primer strikes out of maybe 100 rounds. Most of those were Wolf reloaded ammo, so I'm not sure what primers they use in them, but one of them was on a Federal primer. So that pretty much tells me that I need to do something to that hammer to make it work properly with that light spring. So looks like I'm going forward with my little project of seeing if I can drill it out and make it lighter so that it'll work a little bit better. Outside of that, I just chronographed some 38 Special, which are now up into the plus P pressure range. So any rounds I reload for that will have to be marked just so that I know not to put them in a gun that is for 38 special only.
So but the Chrono survived this time?
The Chrono survived.
Okay, good, good.
Yeah. It's on a lucky streak right now, so I'm getting worried. It's kind of getting to that point where eventually something's going to go wrong, right?
We tease him, guys, because the first time he put his Chrono up, his first shot, he put right through the screen. So
no, it wasn't the first shot. It wasn't the first shot. I had Chronoed, like, I don't know, we'll say 20 rounds out of one gun, and I'm like, oh, let's, and I had just bought a new gun. I'm like, oh, I might as well Chrono out of this, because it's a 5-inch barrel instead of the 4.5, I think, the first gun was. And first round, right into the screen, like not even like, oh, you know, you hit like one of the arms or something like that where it's easy to replace. Like, no, this thing is just take it to the scrapyard. It's done. But yeah, so it survived. But yeah, so I finally made power factor for I-Core. So hopefully that'll go well now. So moving on, guns in the news. Benny, why don't you take story number one?
I don't know if anyone's listened to our stats when it comes to Maple Seed. We're great shots. Okay. In, I think it was 2002, Canadian Sniper made the longest confirmed kill at, I believe it was 2,310, or was it 200, I don't remember. It's either 2,310 or 2,430 meters.
Well, there was two. One did 2,300 and one did 2,430. There was actually two. And then we're beaten by the British.
Right. And then we were beaten by the British a little bit after that. And then I think even further after that, an American made a 2,300 meter shot. So he made the top five. But then I believe it was a couple of weeks ago, a JTF2, which is basically Canada's equivalent to Delta Forces. They made a confirmed kill at 3,540 meters. So.
Ooh.
Yes. We're pretty good.
So that would take 10 seconds to hit the target after we pulled the trigger.
Yeah, awesome. So we know what we're doing.
And, you know, it was funny when we made the Canadian soldier made the 2,400 shot. He was actually the British government tried to award him, the American government tried to award him a medal for the shot, and the Canadian government refused to have one of our soldiers decorated by a foreign government.
Yeah, apparently that happens a lot.
Yeah,
like there's countless times when the American government or foreign governments want to award our soldiers for acts in combat, and our Canadian and the government refuses to allow them to do that, which I think is ridiculous.
It's stupid.
Like, if you don't want them to wear it on their uniform, fine, but, you know, let them receive the accolades that they deserve, or at least, you know, give your equivalent then.
Yeah. All right, so moving on to main topic, we have Jeremy and Jason from the Reloading podcast, and we heard that, Jeremy, you shoot F-class. So how far out do you shoot in F-class?
600 and 1,000 yards.
Okay.
So what is that, roughly 900 meters? And
something like that. Pretty much very, very far away.
Reach out there and touch them.
Yeah. Yeah, so you obviously, you custom reload every round to get the optimal accuracy out of that.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I've used that same load that I've used in F class. I've actually taken my 308 out to 1,260 yards on a 12-inch by 12-inch steel plate.
Wow, that's awesome.
So 1,000 yards isn't too bad.
Yep. And Jason, you've been reloading for a while, and clearly you know how to shoot. You're shooting out at 500 yards at that steel gong.
Yep.
So that's why we had the two of them on here for this week's main topic, which is reloading for rifles, since Thomas and I know nothing about it, and Benny's just learning how to shoot pistols. You'll probably notice a lot of similarities between this episode and our pistol reloading episode, as the process is similar, but there are some very important differences. So because of this, we brought on the other guys. I figured we'd kind of go through this the same way that we went through the other ones, so kind of just pretending what equipment we would use, single stage, something like a lead press, cost effective, and it's really popular for the new shooter. Lead dies, are they pretty much the, I assume they're the same as for pistol dice are kind of like the, I don't, cost effective, that's the right word to use.
Cheap.
The cost effective die. Yeah, frugal, yeah. They're for your good old Scotchman.
Why is the thistle the official flower of Scotland?
I don't know.
They were too cheap to hire a gardener.
You realize 10X is going to be running the show now, eh?
Well, it's about time. We don't get enough listener feedback.
All right, so outside of that, how to set up your specific dies. Pretty much the instructions will always have that information. And...
Well, I get a question, though.
Okay.
Instead of using the cost-effective dies, what dies would you use for rifle shooting? What would you recommend?
I use for like my match dies, competition ammo, I use a Redding body die. The Redding dies are great. They're a little bit more on the expensive side, but I mean, they're top notch, die. I actually use it, the Redding body die, that will actually resize basically the entire body of the case, the rifle case, and every single one's exactly the same. And then I use a Lee Collet neck die. So I do have a cheap die in there, but I use the Lee Collet neck die, because it doesn't have an expander ball on it. If you want rifle ammo that's got very little run out, those Lee Collet neck dies are great, or you can get like a Redding bushing neck die, as long as the die doesn't have an expander ball going through the neck. Because if you got an expander ball going through the neck, you end up actually inducing run out on your round, which is bad when you're trying to shoot a long ways out there.
What is run out?
Yeah, I was just gonna say.
The easiest way to explain it is run out is how far off center is the bullet and the bullet nose compared to the center line of the case head and the case body. So, I mean, if you got like an expander ball going through there, through the neck sizing process, or like in a full length resizing guy or something like that, it's going to pull that neck one way or another. So that neck isn't going to be perfectly in line with the body of the case or the case head. And the bullet will actually enter the chamber, or it'll enter the barrel a different way other than straight down center bore.
Okay, so it's almost like a little cock to the side, per se.
Like a slight cant to it.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Of course, if you don't have a well-made rifle, you might not be able to tell the difference anyway.
Okay.
So, I mean, my rifle, you know, I've had the bolt face trued up. I've had the receiver trued up, the barrels trued up. I mean, everything is in sync with one another. So, I mean, if you got a factory barrel, I mean, you still want the less amount of run out that you can get, but you may not be able to tell the difference quite as much as if you have a $3,000 receiver that's been trued up and a $500 barrel and so on and so on.
Okay, so the average person buying a Savage rifle, maybe to go do a little bit of hunting, something like that, that run out, I don't want to say it won't make a difference, but it won't affect the accuracy by a dramatic enough difference to really, I guess, validate worrying about it.
And generally for what your typical hunter's going to do, you know, 100, couple hundred, maybe 300 yards, it's not going to make that big of a difference. I mean, it can depending on the amount of run out, but generally, you know, like I do have some factory rifles that I use for hunting, and I don't even check the run out in them. I just get a good load for them and go. So Jason may have a different view on it, but.
Well, what's your view on it, Jason?
I don't have one. I just don't want any run out or as little as possible. So I set my dies up, like even my Lee full body, full length dies. You can set that up to where I had 1,000th run out was what I got out of it.
How would you measure a run out?
We have a gauge that'll measure it.
Okay.
I actually have a gauge that'll measure the run out in the case without a bullet in it. And I went that route because I was having an issue and I kept tracing it back to the case. So I bought this other tool and I had a die that's got an issue.
Oh, okay. So what sort of rifle die do you prefer?
I copied Jeremy.
You copied Jeremy? Okay.
Yeah, I have a tight chamber that the bolt is tough to lock when I full length size my cases, and I couldn't get the shoulder. It was the shoulder that was bumping in the chamber. I couldn't get it to go back far enough, so I picked Jeremy's brain one day and ended up going with that Redding body die, and that fixed it.
There you go. All right, so the only other thing that you'd really need is the case holder, so just make sure you get the proper size for the right the right caliber that you plan on reloading and for the right press that you're using. I figure for this example, we'll use a 223 Remington or 556, however you want to call it. Can you reload both pieces of brass with the same set of dies?
Yes.
Yes? All right. So I kind of pre-selected some components to use, and this is because this is what I have downstairs waiting to be reloaded. So for powder, I picked the H4198, and the way I picked that was because it was a powder that you needed to put the least amount in for each casing, so I figured I'd get the most loading out of it.
complete yeah, opposite of me.
Frugal.
Sorry, Jeremy?
Which powder was that?
The H4198.
Oh, 4198, okay.
Yeah. So for finding reloading data, we kind of actually talked about how we find our data. Jason, why don't you start us off? What's your favorite source for reloading data?
Quick Loads is my favorite.
Okay. Is that a book or is that online?
That is a reloading program that you purchase.
Oh, okay. So is that, I assume that updates, it's always up to date. You'll never get old information.
No, I have old information. You have to purchase the update.
Oh, okay. Jeremy, how about you?
I got about 10 manuals that I use along with the powder manufacturer website. And really what I do, it really depends on what my ultimate goal is at the end game. You know, if I'm looking for precision, then I'm needing velocity because I'm shooting way out there. Because I do shoot 223 out at 600 yards for F-class as well, just to have fun. I looked for a load that had a high velocity, but it was also an extremely accurate round or extremely accurate powder, and it actually gave me the most case feel. Is what I look for. Because I tend to find those make the most accurate rounds. When you get a lot of case fill and get kind of a slight compression of the powder, I tend to get my better powder burn.
Okay. How do you determine what powder is more accurate than another?
I do a lot of research between the precision Facebook pages I'm on, Googling, and I look for that case fill. I look for the loads that have the most powder in the cases. And then what I do is I'll pick two or three, most of the time three, sometimes four. And then I'll actually, I'll buy 1 pound of each powder. And then I'll run through my test loads that way. And then whatever's most accurate, I'll go buy an 8 pound keg of it and run with it.
Okay. Like when you're picking how much you're actually going to put in each one, so you looked at in your book, and there's the minimum and the maximum, will the amount of powder that someone who, we'll just say for plinking ammo, will it really matter how much powder they put into each case? Will it affect their accuracy enough?
If I'm doing just plinking ammo, I'm really not looking for all that much accuracy. I'm just looking for plinking.
Yeah.
And I'll You know, say you got a minimum of 23, I might bump it up to 23 and a half, 24, and then just run with it.
Yeah, just to be sure that you always have enough powder in each round.
Yeah, exactly. Just make sure everything cycles, like if you're using an AR or something like that.
Yeah.
Do you find you get a better, more accuracy with the compressed load? Like a better burn rate with it?
I do, yeah. I get better accuracy with a slightly compressed load. I mean, it seems like I get my standard deviation and my extreme spreads are much closer with a slightly compressed load.
When you say compressed load, sorry, does that mean you're physically compressing your powder in the case, or does that have another meaning that I'm missing?
Nope, that's exactly what it means. You basically, you know, when you're testing the load, you know, you go from min to max to test your loads to see what's high pressure. Well, you know, I do the same thing, and towards the top end, you'll start getting powder where it's kind of come up in the neck a little bit. And then when you seat that bullet, you can actually feel it pushing the powder and kind of packing the powder down. But you don't want to do that for any powders that don't have that C at the end of, you know, towards the upper end where you can actually compress it. I mean, there are powders where don't have the compression symbol, and then there are powders that do have that compression symbol. You don't want to compress a powder that doesn't need to be compressed. That could be bad.
What's the compression symbol?
Oh, there's just a big C. Like you say, you might have, say you look at a load and it goes from 23 to say 26.0 C. That C means you can compress that load. You can compress that powder.
Uh-huh.
So I tend to find my most accurate loads not fully compressed, but not, you know, not compressed, just that kind of slight compression. You might feel a kernel or two break, and I mean that tends to give me my best accuracy.
Okay. So for the primer, I selected Winchester because, once again, that's what I have downstairs waiting to be loaded up. When you're looking at your reloading information, sometimes it actually makes a recommendation of the primer. Does it really matter which primer you select, Jason?
If you switch after you've developed your load, yeah, it can very well matter. But for the initial load development, I'd say just pick whatever you want.
Okay. And for the bullet, I picked the Campro 55 grain boat tail full metal jacket, so the BT-FMJ. So that's a pretty popular low-cost Canadian option. I think they're actually made in Quebec. So you see them all over the place. When I was looking up for reloading data, though, based on the powder and the bullets, there was no FMJ option. So how do you determine which bullet type is the closest to the construction that you're buying? Like for mine, I think the two options were S-Fire and SPR-SP.
Well, if you look in your manual and you got a soft point that's 55 grain, that full metal jacket, it's got a full metal jacket, but you're still going to have lead core in it. So, I mean, the construction's the same. Your OAL may differ, but you can still use the same powder charges for a 55 grain full metal jacket compared to a 55 grain, you know, soft point, spire point, or whatever.
Okay, so you can use the same information for a different bullet. It does translate.
Yeah, your OAL is just going to be different, is all.
And OAL is?
Overall length.
Okay. Thanks. All right. When it comes to actual selection of the case for cases, whether you pick Federal, Hardy, whoever, whatever your favorite manufacturer, does it really matter when you're just making plinking ammo, Jeremy?
It doesn't matter what case you go with, but make sure all your cases have the same head stamp.
Aha.
If you don't, you can and will run into high pressure issues because you have, you know, let's take 308. I shoot a lot of Peterson 308 brass. Then you got Lapua and Hornaday and Winchester. Well, Winchester might have 57 grains of water capacity to it, case capacity, where the Peterson might only have 55 grains of water capacity. So you got two full grains there, less capacity in the Peterson compared to the Winchester. And if you go to put the same load in, say, the Winchester, and it's an upper end load, you go put that same load into the Peterson case, you're going to have less capacity, which means you're going to have higher pressures, and it's going to be a really hot load. So you want to at least make sure they have the same headstands.
Okay, and does that more for the high end when you're talking about maximum loads, or does it still pretty much hold true for starting loads or the lower end loads?
Well, whatever load you go with, if one has a lower capacity than the other, it's going to be higher pressures. So, I mean, for me, to keep it safe all the way around and get in a good habit, I do it for plinking loads and I do it for my match loads. I just make sure I have the same headstand.
Okay. So pretty much you can use any case, just make sure you're, I guess you could almost say grouping them together based on their head stamp.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So first step is your brass prep. So this is to clean the brass to protect the dies. It helps make it look pretty, which is always nice. It's also a good time to remove any brass that's damaged, or if you happen to accidentally pick up any of the steel casing stuff. So pretty much there's just the cleaning process to it. Jason, how do you like to clean your brass?
I decap mine first, and then I throw it in the stainless steel tumbler. And when I'm done with that, I throw it into corn cob with some new finish to finish it off.
Oh, really?
Why do you throw it in the corn cob after?
The stainless steel, I use the Lemmy Shine Dawn. It literally strips everything off of the case. The case will start oxidizing real fast. So I put it in the cob, for one, it'll dry it. And two, the wax in it will protect it so it'll stay shinier longer. I like shiny brass.
That's a good idea.
I didn't know that. I just started doing the steel cleaning, but I don't throw it into the corn cob after. I never thought of that.
So it'll slow down the oxidizing process then?
Yep.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I've had brass out there in a sealed up baggie for a couple of years. It's still very shiny. It hasn't started oxidizing yet.
That's good.
But you do want to make sure you get the water out of your cases. So I spin it out in a media separator to get as much water as I can before I throw it in there. If you leave the primer in it and it's got water, that corn cob gets in there, you're going to have a mess inside your case.
Okay. How do you like to clean your brass, Jeremy?
I just throw mine in a tumbler and corn cob and crushed walnut shells mixed. Throw it in there.
You mix the corn cob and the walnut together?
Yeah, generally a 50-50, but I mean, most of my rifle brass, it doesn't touch the ground. I mean, because I shoot both bolt rifles most of the time.
Okay.
But my brass doesn't touch the ground.
Okay, so you're not cleaning dirt and mud and other crud that's stuck onto it.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. So do you also deprime your brass before you clean it?
Depends on what I'm doing. I mean, my match ammo, I'll go ahead and decap it and then throw it in there. And then the tool I have, it pops out any media that might get in the flash hole. So I don't ever worry about it.
Oh, okay.
Other stuff, just plinking ammo, I just throw it in without decapping, and then I worry about it later.
Okay. when you do decap it, how do you do that?
I generally just run the Lee Collet neck die through, and it'll pop it out. Or I use a if it's new brass that I'm gonna be using for match, I'll use a Lee Universal decapper. That way I'm not messing with the rest of the brass, and I'll pop everything out. And of course, those cases, you know, I'm having to uniform the primer pockets and uniform the flash holes, and you know, maybe take out crimp and whatnot.
Okay. So do you do that before you do any sizing? Like, the primer pocket, you said you reform the primer pocket?
Oh, yeah. I'll uniform the primer pocket to make sure it's nice and square at the bottom. so I get a good solid seat on the primer. Yeah, I generally do all that before I size the body or the neck and okay. turn the neck. So I turn the necks of those brass too. So
what do you mean by turn the neck? Sorry.
When you look at a case, you might have uneven spots where there's thicker brass on one side of the case neck than the other. You know, what I do is I take the case necks down to where they're the same size all the way around the case neck. And what that does is it gives uniform bullet release. So when you fire off that round, all sides of the brass are letting go of the bullet at the same time. And it helps with accuracy.
Okay. Okay, so I guess the next step would be sizing. Brings the brass back down to spec size. If at that point in time you're depriming, if you didn't deprime it before you cleaned it, that would also be when you would do it. So you have to lube rifle cases. How do you lube your cases, Jason?
You have the Dillon spray lube. I just use the homemade version.
Okay.
Lay it out on a box or a tray and spray it and shake it around so it's turning. Spray it again. I spray it about 3 times. Let that dry about a minute or 2, and then it's ready to go.
Okay. And how important is the lube on the case?
Extremely.
Extremely. if you don't put lube on, what will happen?
You'll stick a case inside that die.
You'll be ordered a stuck case removal.
You'll either have to purchase a stuck case remover or make your own, or else send the die into the manufacturer.
So pretty much all your reloading at that point in time is done for the day.
Screeching stop, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
At least for a couple of days until you make your own.
Yeah. So why is it so hard on the press or on the die when you are trying to resize it, even if I put all that lube on there, Jeremy?
Well, I mean, you get two metals. If you don't, you get two metals that are creating friction. And especially if you get the expander ball, I mean, you got to have some kind of lube. Not to mention you got carbon buildup in the neck. And so, I mean, you add all those things up, and if you don't put lube on, then, yeah, you're going to be cussing yourself for sure. Now, some dyes, like the Redding body dye, you know, I use a very light lube, but you still got those two metals that are creating friction that, I mean, because you're taking a case that's been fired in a chamber, it could be a loose chamber, and then you're bringing it back down to Sammy Specs, and, you know, you're creating a lot of pressure by doing that. And
yeah. Is there such a thing as too much lube?
Oh, yeah.
What will happen if you put too much lube in or on?
So in a full body dye, you'll actually get lube dents where you'll just have this dent that doesn't really look like anything. It's just from the pressure. The lube couldn't get away from it, so it actually pushed in your case a little bit.
And does that make that piece or that case garbage or?
No, it's okay. I wouldn't use it for my F-class shooting or anything like that if I was to be like Jeremy, but yeah, for plinking loads, it's fine. It ain't no big deal.
It'll fire back out.
So like after you've shot it, if you retrieve that same case back, it'll actually have pushed back out?
Yep.
Unbuckled? Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, cool. I guess after that, the next step, the most awesome step of all, would be trimming your brass down. So this is to just get rid of the extra brass that's kind of expanded. How do I phrase it? I guess down the chamber. Would that be the right way to say it?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. Plus your die actually, depending on what die you use, the expander ball will actually lengthen your case.
Okay, so that's pretty much why it's getting longer. How do you guys prefer to trim your brass down?
I use the Lyman Easy Trim, and it's got a pilot, and then it's got, you attach it to your cutter head, and I use a drill and just zoop, and it trims every case back down to where I want it to be.
When you say drill, do you mean like a hand drill?
Like a power drill, yeah.
Yeah.
Cordless power drill, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
actually sanded off the very bottom of the pilot. That way I trim all my 308 brass down to 2 inches even. That way I know every single piece of brass is exactly the same trim length and everything.
Okay. How important is trimming in a plinking rifle?
Well, if you don't trim and you're over your chamber spec, then, I mean, you could end up pinching the bullet inside the beginning of the barrel and cause a explosion. So, pretty important.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is not a good thing.
No, okay. No, booms are not good.
Oh, geez, yeah, especially I imagine that would not be, or that would be quite the high pressure boom.
Yeah.
Compared to a pistol or something else.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Wow.
Jeremy, what happened to your fast brass? You don't use that for your competition or what?
Yeah, I actually use that for the Peterson brass, just because I got like a couple thousand rounds of it. But my hunting ammo, my 30-30, you know, stuff that I'm not going to do, but 20 rounds a year.
And you don't want to change a setting on your machine type of thing?
Exactly, yeah. I got the fast brass machine set exactly where I want it for my 308 match ammo. Set it and forget it. I just leave it as is. And, okay. You know, my other stuff, like my daughter 243, I actually make her hand trim her 243 press. keeps her occupied. Mm-hmm. But she started, well, I mean, she started reloading when she was 10, so she, I mean, she's fine. She can do it. But, I 243, 30, 37 millimeter. Yeah, I'm generally not loading any more than 20 rounds in a couple of years. So, okay. But yeah, that fast brass machine, that'll go through some brass trimming quick.
Okay. So after you've trimmed it, you don't flatten the brass, but there's clearly some excess metal hanging off there. How do you get rid of that, Jason?
I have a hand tool to chamfer and deburr.
Okay.
I have the motorized tools too, but I just prefer to do it by hand for my bolt gun cases. If I have a whole bunch of 223 or something to do, plinking ammo, then I'll run it through the motorized brass prep machine.
Okay. What brass prep machine do you have?
I have a RCBS. And then I also got the, what in the heck is that called? It's the company that has the Platinum Series as one of their models. Frankfurt Arsenal.
Okay.
That one's also, the reason I got it is because it can trim too. It trims, it sits off the shoulder. So the accuracy wasn't quite what I wanted for my bolt gun ammo, but for 223. It's very good.
Okay. So, plinking wise, it's good. Is the RCBS mm-hmm. good for your bolt gun, or is that?
Yeah, it is. It's sitting out in the barn, and now that it's summer, I reload in the house.
Yeah.
I don't feel like walking out to the barn. It's hot outside.
Oh. Okay. So, I guess, do either of your trimmers work through the flash hole? That makes sense? Like the offset from it?
I totally don't understand what you're asking.
Okay. I got the, what's it called? It's the Lee hand trimmer.
Oh,
no.
Okay. See, that is what I would call the economical way of doing it. For people who don't know, you put the case in, like a case holder on one end, and you attach a cutting blade to different lengths metal rod, I guess you would call it, and mm-hmm. so you attach that, so you that rod goes all the way through the case and through the flash hole, and it sits on the case holder, and that's where it rests against.
My Easy Lineman does that. It has the length, the case length pilot, and then you hook it to the trimmer head. Yeah, mine does that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so pretty much you always got to make sure that you you can't prime it until you've done trimming it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So that's what you meant by you filed it down to where you're 2 inches exactly, Jeremy?
Yes. Yeah.
And you don't find that machine or that the part that sticks through the flash hole doesn't like wear down over time or what?
I keep checking it, but I mean, since I only use it for my hunting ammo, I mean, I'm really not as concerned with my hunting ammo as I am my match ammo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so as we previously discussed, there's no way you can skip trimming. All right, so after that, priming would be your next step. Put the fresh case in there. You mentioned that you uniform the primer pocket, and that's not so much about the sides of the primer, but the depth that it sits in, correct?
Correct. That way, it makes it a nice squared off pocket hole on the bottom. That way, when you seat the primer, you're seating the primer to the same depth as, you know, from one case all the way through the rest of the batch.
Okay.
It's a consistency thing. I mean, with accuracy and precision ammo, you want one round to be almost exactly like the next round.
Okay. So that's not at all the same as swaging a primer pocket. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So swaging is more about when you have a crimp primer pocket and you're trying to uncrimp it. Would that be a fair way of saying it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what's the difference when you're shopping for primers, the difference between the small, large, and Magnum?
Small and large are different sizes.
Okay, so they're physically different sizes. Okay, what about the Magnums then?
The Magnums have a hotter flame to them when they ignite.
Okay, so their components are different.
Or more in it. I'm not exactly sure, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
There's a word for it. Starts with a B. I can't remember the name of it. But yeah, it'll burn hotter, and generally you have a longer flame to it on the Magnums.
Okay. Is it okay to mix up Magnum versus non-Magnum when you're loading?
Me? I wouldn't know. No. If you start with Magnum and you got a load with Magnum, then finish that load with, you know, you use the same load for all those Magnum primers that you have. I use Magnum primers in quite a few things, especially if I'm going to use it as a hunt round. Because, okay, now y'all don't laugh, but when it gets cold down here, you know, I want to make sure that I get a good ignition on my hunt rounds, you know. That way I know there's not a misfire and I can drop that deer, so.
Okay. Well, that makes sense, though.
So would you almost say then that the Magnums are more reliable?
In hunting situations, I would say yes, but I mean, I also use Ventress primers a lot too, so.
Okay.
They would be more reliable.
Okay. Well, since you
brought would be more consistent.
Yes.
Okay. So what's the difference between a Ventress primer and a non-Ventress primer, I guess?
So Ventress primers are made by the employees that have been doing that for a while. So the chemical in them is more consistent fill. There's more of an exact amount so that they will ignite closer to the same temperature every time.
Okay, so it's you're getting the senior level guy who makes them versus the guy who's on day one.
Yep.
Okay. So after this, well, for pistols, next thing would be expanding the case. Do you need to expand any cases for rifles?
Depends.
What do you mean by depends?
Well, I cast 30-30 bullets from a 30-30.
Okay.
And those I do have to expand a little bit to make sure I get them all the way in without shaving any of the lead. But your typical person, say you're plinking ammo 223, jacketed ammo, no, you're not going to have to expand it at all.
No, okay. Okay, so then moving on to powder, so just filling up that case with powder. What's your favorite method of weighing out the powder?
RCBS Chargemaster.
Okay, and what makes that your favorite?
I just push some buttons and let it do its thing.
Okay.
It makes life easy.
It makes life easy. Okay, Jeremy, how do you like loading up your cases?
I use a Hornaday Auto Charge.
Those are not cheap.
I just hit some buttons and let it do its thing.
So I can interject. So the difference between rifle and, say, pistol, you're using a volume type of powder dispenser, but with rifle, you're doing your actual weight?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, with pistol, I just run it through my Hornaday Progressive, and I'm good.
Okay. Can you still use the same volumetric scales that you'd use for your pistol stuff with your rifle?
You can. Could. Like, when I set up my Progressive, I'll sit there and throw the charges until when it comes out in volume, I'm getting the approximate weights that I'm wanting, like my plinking ammo, and then, you know, I go to running my plinking rifle rounds with my Progressive.
Okay. Like a lot of things, how in-depth you want to get into it, and you guys are obviously at that level where going with the auto charge systems are much more beneficial, or consistent, I guess that would be the right way to say it.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Everything seems to be about consistency here.
Ding, ding, ding.
Which we are not.
Keyword.
All right. And seat in your bullet. So pretty much put your bullet in. I guess if you have an overall length or a magazine size, that would kind of predetermine where you're going to put your... or how deep you're going to put your bullet in. Really, is there much more to it than that? Just pretty much put your bullet on top, crank that handle, and once you have it set up right, it'll just go to the right depth every time.
Jeremy, you want to take that one?
Well, depends on what you want at the end game. I know I keep saying that, but I mean, it really does depend on what your end result that you want. Say plinking ammo, you just want to run through it quick. You can load to the manual length that they use with the loads that they use, and all you got to do is check, make sure they fit in the magazine. That's it. You know, let's say with my 7mm rim mag that I use for hunting, it's rim 700. They're known for extremely long throats. So I actually have it longer than the book OAL, but it also fits the magazine. So I do it that way, but I use the Hornaday OAL gauge. That way I know exactly how far I can lengthen that round before I hit the lands and grooves.
Okay. What's the benefit of having a longer round versus a shorter one?
It really depends on the bullet. It really depends on the bullet. You know, some bullets with the bullet profile, the ogive, all that good stuff, you know, it may like, you know, a 20,000th of an inch jump where, you know, I have a 223 round match load that, you know, I see it clear out to 0.002 inches away from the lands of grooves because that's where it likes it. It all comes down to testing. And the way you test to find out which, you know, what the bullet likes, what your rifle likes.
Okay. What order do you go in when you're trying to, like, I understand you've kind of already figured out, you know, the gun, what round it likes, and, like, roughly the right kind of things. If you're going to change a powder or something like that, then you're only limited to changing the powder. But if you got a new gun and knew it in a caliber you didn't have, what order would you go in for these things to try and see how it affects the accuracy? Like, you've talked about, like, the length, how much powder you put in there, the length of the case, because you've talked about how you trimmed yours down a little bit more, things like that. Do you have a general order that you would go in?
What I do is I'll, you know, I buy my rifle. Say I was to go out and buy a 300 Win Mag. I get all my manuals out. I look at all the different data they have in there. I also look at the powder manufacturers, look to see what data they have there. And then I'm part of AmmoGuide.com as well, and I look at all their stuff on there as well. So I get all the load data. I look at all the different powders, and before I even buy a powder or bullet or anything like that, I actually, you know, I look at all the data first. I'm a numbers cruncher type guy, so that's just kind of what I do. And then I'll figure out my bullet, and then I go from there, find out what length I want the round, figure out what powders I want that gives me that slightly compressed load, and then I'll start putting rounds together. And then what I do is me personally, I start off every single bullet, every single round, where I'm sitting at 0.02 inches off the lands. And then once I find a good, decent, accurate load that way, then I'll start tweaking the length of the round. Of course, by then I know exactly how far out I can put that bullet. So.
Okay. All right. So, do you have to crimp a bullet into your cases?
No, you don't have to.
Did it beneficial to do it?
Depends on the gun.
Okay, so
like tube fed, I would probably want them crimped a little bit. My Smith & Wesson 500 Magnum, yeah, I want that one crimped. But for my AR-10, nah, I never worried about crimping.
No, okay. And do you need to get a separate die for crimping, or is that is it like pistols where it's kind of built into the seating die?
It's built in, but a lot of people have problem with crimping and seating at the same time. I'm sure every one of you have seen the pictures of the blown out shoulders on a case. I can do it. I set my dies up to do it right. It takes a little practice, but to tell you the truth, I'd prefer to have a second die just so I have no issue.
Okay. So it's a preference thing. All right, so pretty much at that point in time, you have your loaded case. Did we miss anything in that list of actions there? Or sound about right?
I think so.
Okay. Anything else you guys would want to add on to that when it comes to reloading rifle ammunition?
Depends on what I'm loading it for.
Yeah.
If I'm loading for a match, then I also turn the next too. I briefly discussed it earlier. So if I'm doing a match ammo, I like every case to be completely consistent. I mean, I go down to checking the case capacity of every single case too, to make sure that, you know, if I have a set of 100 rounds, a lot of 100 rounds that I take to a match, every single case has got the same case capacity or is at least within 0.1 grain water capacity of all the others.
You're talking about water capacity. How do you measure that in a case?
I have some primer plugs from 21st Century Shooting, and the primer is out. What you do is you just plug it, you set it on the scale. You know, the scale come out with a number. You tar it, and then what you do is fill it with water. You know, to it's nice and even on top, and then you set the case back with the primer plug in it and the water, and whatever weight's there is your water capacity because you've already zeroed out for the case and the plug.
Okay, and that's just about being consistent with the volumetric space that's inside the case then?
Yes.
Okay. Do you notice a lot of variations within the same brand, the same pile of brass, or
it depends on how much you want to spend on your brass. Like Peterson 308 wind brass, extremely consistent. They're all within 0.3 grains. I run with that. I'm good with that. Winchester, I've seen as much as a grain difference.
Okay.
And some. I actually did a spreadsheet on a 1308 wind brass over 9 different head stamps that included all, you know, differences. I think Winchester's one of the worst. And actually Federal Peterson was the best as far as cape capacity, consistency. Then it was Federal. Actually, Lapua kind of was about middle of the pack. And then,
Wow, I would have thought they would have been better than that for such a well-known brand.
No, they're not real consistent brass. I want everybody to know the Lapua guys. I mean, Peterson is just, and when it comes to 308 limb brass, Peterson's top dog, extremely consistent.
Okay. So does that mean you buy, I guess you buy all your, like you actually buy brass? Like I've never bought brass. I've only ever picked it up off a range.
For my match rounds, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what does a box of Peterson, say 100 brass cost?
About $75, $80.
That's US, so it's $100 Canadian.
Yeah. So I get, about $100. But you'll get, you could easily get 20 to 30 loadings out of each case.
See, when you reload, you're reloading for accuracy, not for cost effectiveness.
Exactly.
Correct. You don't have to worry about somebody else picking up your brass either, because you're picking up each one after you're done.
Exactly.
Yep.
And my next, I was also going to ask the case capacity. Does that reflect in the weight of the case on itself? Like, if I were just to weigh my cases empty, would you see the variation in the weight of the case? Because I know when I was doing my 50, because I ended up measuring each case, tearing it, filling it up with powder, then measuring it again. And I found that I was getting grain, even up to 2.5 grains difference between all the same head stamp.
Mm-hmm. Weighing your cases is, you're just spinning your wheels. Because you can actually have two cases of the same exact weight, and one might have less capacity, the other one with more capacity.
Okay.
And you could, I've actually ran into this on my 308 test, is there were some cases that were actually heavier than some other cases, but the lighter cases, the heavier cases actually had more capacity than the lighter cases. Because when it comes to the case, the metallurgy, depending on what metals they use it, depending on how much metal they put in the case head, it can make it weigh less or more. So, I mean, it has nothing to do with the actual internal capacities.
Okay. Yeah, I know. I found it easier to drop my powder straight into the case and weigh and use the case as like my dish that I'm weighing it in.
There's too much variation in the case, so that's the problem.
Right. So I was putting the case on, tearing it so it was zeroing the scale, dropping my powder, and then weighing it and seeing what my powder drop was, like that. And I just happened to notice that my cases weren't all weighing the same. So I was just curious how that reflected.
All right, Jason, what's your favorite method for testing your ammunition?
For accuracy?
I guess it'd be pretty much for everything, for accuracy, how do you check to make sure it fits, your chambering, reliability, things like that.
Put it in my chamber and see if it chambers.
Okay. Just as simple as that, put it in and see if it locks, if you can lock the bolt.
Yeah.
Okay, and how do you test it for accuracy?
He pulls the trigger.
Shoot it on paper.
But I mean, what's your?
I'm waiting for someone to say that.
Do you do like? Do you like doing like the ladder test or?
I do ladder and OCW. I just kind of mix them up randomly, whatever I'm in the mood for.
Okay.
But
remember that day.
What's that, Jeremy?
I said whatever he can remember that day.
Bite me, midget. basically, what I do now that I have this quick loads is it gives me, with a little bit of knowledge, you can figure out your accuracy nodes. And I'll load like 1% below, 0.5% below the actual recommended accuracy node, and then 0.5% above and 1% above. And I'll make up 5 shots of each and shoot them on paper.
Okay, what's an accuracy node?
So the amount of time that the bullet is in your barrel, the speed of sound moves at a certain speed. My program will tell you how many times that vibration has moved out to your barrel and come back to the chamber. Moved out to your barrel and come back to your chamber. And somewhere in there is a reasonable amount of time that I can actually get my bullet out of the barrel.
Okay.
And I want the vibration to be away from the end of the barrel as it comes out.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so I'll make up those five different loads in like five rounds each. And then I will see my absolute accuracy node there.
Okay. And what's your favorite way of testing it, Jeremy?
I use ladder load, generally at anywhere between 400 to 500 yards. I'll shoot my ladder test. And then I'll come back and tweak the overall length. And then I'll go back out again and shoot it at whatever distance I did the ladder test at. So if I do it at 400, then I'll go out and shoot five rounds each load with, it'll be the same load, but just with different lengths, OALs. And I'll shoot that at 400 yards to see which groups give me the tightest group.
Okay. Out of curiosity, why 400 yards?
Well, you want, when you do a ladder test, since you're initially doing the ladder test, is one round each load. Since you're doing that, if you get any closer than 300, then you're not going to be able to find that horizontal plane where all, like, a group of three are going to be sitting. So you want it, you know, 300 or further. You know, the further you can get out, the better, as long as you're confident in your shooting. So I use, if it's a windy day, then I'll go at 400. If it's, you know, a fairly calm day, then I'll do it at 500. And what you do is you shoot every round and look for that horizontal plane where you have three different charges, but they're all sitting within the same line on the piece of paper. And then what you do is you pick the middle load, and I'll pick the middle load, and I'll test different OALs to see which one, you know, likes the bullets where they're at. I actually did a write-up for Sierra on a ladder test. I could get y'all the link for that. I did it for the 69 grain tip match king, a ladder test I did where the ladder test resulted in by the time it was all said and done, ended up with a 2-inch group at 400 yards with a 223.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, if you can put the link right in the show notes, we'll put it in.
Yeah, no, that's to me, it's crazy that, not crazy, but you're shooting just to try and figure out, like, what you're best loaded at 400 yards, and I don't think I've ever even shot further than 200. And I think the one time I did it was like, I got four rounds left, let's just launch them down there and see if I can hit a target at 200 yards.
I think the furthest I ever shot was 300, and I was 15 years old when I shot it. That's the last time I shot that far, because my range is 100 yards. That's it.
I was going to say, shooting a 22 up in the air doesn't count as shooting 300 yards.
It was a 270, and I got all three shots in the black. My uncle was quite impressed.
Good. The gun club I'm part of, our long range is 600 yards is the longest target out there. And I actually take the plates that me and Jason got from a guy, and they're 8-inch round steel plates. And I'll take it at 600 yards and shoot that all day long.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
That's a small target at 600 yards.
Yeah. Aim small, miss small.
I think I've heard that somewhere before.
Yeah, some podcast.
Yeah. All right. Well, it looks like someone wants to join this call.
Hello.
Hey, Jim. How's it going?
Not bad. Not bad. Glad to be on the show, even if I am about an hour and a half late.
Better late than never, right?
Yep, something like that.
Jim, since you're here, why don't you tell listeners how they can listen to your podcast?
That's not my podcast. It belongs to the five of us. Mike created it, and it belongs to Jeremy, Trevor, myself, and that knucklehead out there in liberal land, Jason. Anyway, I don't know the link, to tell you the truth, but I'm sure, Mike, I hope you will be kind enough to include the link to the show, to the archives at least. But it's on the Firearms Radio Network. I know that.
I'll make sure to include a link in the show notes for the show.
Appreciate that, sir.
Anything else anyone would like to add before we let you guys go? How about you guys go through your taglines there?
You better die. Go ahead, Dave. You can do yours.
Keep your powder dry.
Hey, you're small.
You all forgot to keep that brush shiny, and whatever you do, don't suck on it. And to tell you, I'll do my own tagline again. Squeeze. Don't yank that trigger.
All right. Thanks again to Jeremy and Jason and Jim for joining us at the last minute there. We really appreciate all the help and good information that you had, since we don't really know much about, or I should say we didn't know very much about rifle reloading, and now we're full of information. So, Benny, you're gonna try reloading 223 as well?
Yeah, I'm not sure when I'm gonna start that. I guess I should probably get on that before next week, seeing as I have enough. I just realized I have enough for the course, but I don't necessarily have enough for the charity shoot, which I'm shooting after the course. So, I gotta get some reloading done.
Okay.
Well, how can you be shooting the charity shoot after the course? They let you run the course of fire for you on Friday?
Because what's happening is during the course, they're going to be setting up for the charity shoot on Saturday. They're expecting to finish the course around 4, I think. Maybe a little earlier, maybe a little later, I don't remember. But it works out that, you know, then they have to set up for the Maple Seed. The only, course of fire they have to set up for after the course would be the Maple Seed, portion. And, that's pretty simple. So, I'll help them set up and then they'll run me through the course. They might run some of the RSOs through it. And then, Bob, your uncle.
Excellent.
That's awesome. Excellent. It's really nice of them to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, last year I didn't get to shoot it. I'm kidding, guys. I'm kidding. I was just over the moon to be there. So, this year I will not be able to walk in, and say hi to everyone. So, I'll have to see you guys another time, but, I will be there for the carbine course and I will be staying in the hotel over the Saturday. So you guys may see me walking around, but probably not.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, and make sure to give the Reloading podcast a listen to. We'll put a link in the show notes for that. They have tons of information, and I mean, they're using words that, you know, might as well have been in a different language because I didn't even understand what they're talking about. But if you want to get real in depth into that long range shooting and the real precise, or I should say the real consistency side of things, then that's a really good place to go and listen and hear a lot of great information, and they're also really fun to listen to. So
yeah, I'm kind of sad Mike didn't make it. I've always liked, we've had Mike on the show in the past too. He's very knowledgeable.
Yeah. Hopefully next time. All right, Thomas, why don't you take us off into events? What's event number one?
Event one this week is this Saturday, July 1st. I just heard about this. The Bancroft Fishing Game is having an open house between 10 and 2. They'll have rifle, pistol, trap, and archery shooting. And it's, they also have accepting new members as well, too. So if you're trying to find a place to shoot and you're up near the Bancroft area, give them a call at 613-332-0667. And for the open house, there is no set fee, but they're just accepting donations. And what's event two, Benny?
Event number two is Carbine Operator Course by Radcroft Tactical, July 7th, Kitchener, Ontario, $2,000. Sorry, $200.
Woohoo.
Wow, their profit margin just went up.
The value is $2,000, but you only have to pay $200 including taxes. So I think that's a pretty good deal.
That
sounds good.
Links in the show notes, but guys, sign up. I think they may still have a couple openings. And training is worth every dollar. Go for it.
And plus, it's a lot of fun. You get to meet a lot of great people when you're doing it, right?
Yeah.
Right, Benny? That's the first time I think I actually met you in person, so.
Yeah, fast course. He's got to put up some more.
Yeah.
I think he's working on it, but.
Yep. So event number three is the 7th Annual Canadian Podcaster Charity Shoot, July 8th, Guelph, Ontario, $40. Links are in the show notes. And if you are planning to attend. I know they're calling out, they're hoping that people would sign up using the practice score link, just so that they had a good, better idea of the number. So if you're planning on going, it'd be awesome if you could go on there and just sign up. You don't even need to give any real personal information. They just pretty much want to know what your name is, your first name, and if you're coming or not. So.
Yeah, I was speaking to Andrew actually, and so far only 45 people have signed up so far, where we had almost 75 last year. So they really need you to sign up so that they have a number, so they know, you know, especially for food and everything else, what they need to bring, T-shirts, everything else. So if you are planning to attend, please sign up so they have a better idea of what to expect.
All right, and event number four, Thomas?
Event number four, the Canadian Sportswoman Society, in association with Feathered Frenzy Outfitters, presents an infield waterfowl event Saturday, August 26th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. You'll learn calling, shot placement, shooting moving targets from standing, laying blinds, decoy setup, and much more. Cost is $50 per person. It's non-refundable. Includes a gift bag, ammo, which is a good deal, skeet, lunch, refreshments, and a chance to win some great prizes. The requirement is in a PAL, a shotgun, and a chair. For more information, contact Lori Ann, and her number is 226-923-0193. There's 20 spots open, and it is a co-ed event, so this is open to men and women. So I'm going to check what I would mind checking out, too, because I've never actually done duck hunting. Sounds good. And event five?
Event five. Florence Gun Club is having their fourth annual club fundraiser. Tickets can be purchased at contactus.fssc@gmail.com. Links in the show notes. Tika T3 Sporter and 223. You can get a Henry 22 long rifle, lever action, over $400. Nice Oakley glasses and some binoculars.
All right, so listener email. This one is from Mr. Uzi. Hey, Mike. It wasn't an autocorrect on my last email. There is no T in cannulare. Unless there's an audio issue on your end, it sounds like you say the word can't you lure. Keep up the good work, Mr. Uzi. And he accompanied that with about five other emails where he had taken a picture of the word and the definition in it. And he is correct. I do pronounce it wrong. And even as you heard me there, I stumbled over it because for whatever reason, I want to put a T in there. So
it's like being Leonard, right?
See this? Yeah. Here comes Thomas's revenge.
How do you say it? Cannulare?
Cannulare. See,
and lanyard.
I can say lanyard. If you have any feedback, questions, or comment, or you want to correct mine or Thomas's spelling, Benny, apparently you have spectacular spelling, or not spelling, no, pronunciation.
My pronunciation is great. My spelling's atrocious.
But if you'd like to point out any of our other horrible flaws, you can do that by emailing us at host@newshootercanada.ca, our Facebook page, or the comment section on our website at newshootercanada.ca. We have no new iTunes or Stitcher reviews. Facebook likes were up to 1,113. And Thomas, do you have any shout-outs this week?
Shout-outs to the organizers of the Orsa Match, the Gun Club. They always get there an hour, hour and a half early, set everything up so everybody can have fun shooting. So to the club and all the guys that run the Orsa League, thank you.
Benny?
I'm going to do a shout out to, Andrew and Gavin. Whatever. I had some stuff I was talking about and they helped me out. So shout out to them and to my lovely wife for, as always, sticking with me, even though I'm a pain in the rump. So thanks.
All right. I just want to shout out Jason and Jeremy one more time for coming on the show and sharing all that great information with us. All right, Thomas, why don't you take us on out of here?
Well, thank you for putting up with us once again. Enjoying the train wreck. Until next week, keep your barrels downrange and smoking.
Time spent at the range is time spent with family.
It's not about the odds, it's about the stakes.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
I really like 22 Mag.
Thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you with any questions or feedback you may have, or if you just want to call shenanigans. You can contact us at host@newshootercanada.ca or through our Facebook page.
The way they look, I like the shiny steel and the polished wood. I don't care if they're big or small, they're for sale until I want them all. I like guns, I like guns, I like guns.
Hello and welcome to New Shooter Canada, episode 139. I'm Mike Kisson, and tonight with me we have a couple of outtakes. All right, let's try that again. I know you guys are older, but you're not a ghost yet.
It's not about the odds, it's about the stakes. Ah, oh, gotta write
Benny,
that one down.
Benny. Do you want us to put it in the show notes for you? I should say, on the case of the carbide dies. If not, you're going to be having to lube those cases.
We got to lube them anyways.
You got to lube them anyways. Yeah. Were you not listening to the show, Thomas?